This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Soa, delighted to have you joining me here on Money Talk at AM 790, your home of talking business. If you've got a question for me during the course of this show, and if you're at a safe, comfortable place where we can chat, and if you feel the chat is important, 437-5000 is, in fact, the local number. Make sure you let Brett, our producer, know that you are in a safe place where we can talk. Now, what I mean by that is that if you're on the Wampanoag Trail driving home around 95 or whatever, that's not necessarily a safe place to talk. If you can pull off the road or find yourself in a safe situation, give Brett a call, let him know that, and he'll put the question you have right on my screen here in front of me. That way you don't have to stay on the line and do something unsafe, and I, on the other hand, can try to help you by answering that question before you reach your destination. So, again, the local number is 437-5000, and we also have a toll-free number, 888-345-0790. That's 888-345-0790. Stocks closed, well, very little change today, sort of a mixed day overall, taking a bit of a breather after posting clearly records for literally five straight days. Energy dropped about 1% as one of the sectors. It's certainly a market that has some level of confidence even still. The problem with that, of course, when the market gets really confident, because remember, it's not really the market, it's people. It's a people market, not a stock market. It's people trading, buying and selling their stuff. The problem with overconfidence, or perhaps confidence, is when that level gets too high, it's harder to push the market considerably higher. On Tuesday, on the Money Talk Roundtable program with my daughter, we do the Get Back to Basics on Tuesdays. She and I together were, in fact, talking about this issue of confidence in emotion and psychology, in how there's a class of investors out there known as the contrarian investors who watch for information about investor confidence. And when the confidence level gets too high, when there's too much desire, too much bullishness for buying, they decide that history has shown us that the closer you get to that level of ultimate exuberance, that ultimate excitement, the ultimate confidence, the higher you get to that, the closer you are to the very top of the market. And you're likely to move from the peak and then start moving your way down to a trough. When people get, you know, the people that have been in the market, the people that were the buyers that got in low and rode that mountain up to the top, and now they're at the very peak, what they've been doing, just as you might be looking for an opportunity to buy something, they've been looking for an opportunity to sell that item they have, which, of course, has gone so high. So if you're buying in at the top because everybody, it seems like, hey, everybody's buying this stock or everybody's buying this fund or whatever it is, everybody's jumping into the market. Well, please believe me, there are the people that have been in the market. For you to be a buyer, somebody has to be a seller. And chances are the people who are selling when you're buying have made a lot of money in the item that they're selling. They're getting out at the top, and your desire to get in is affording them that opportunity to actually get out and lock in their profits. Buy low, sell high. So you are on the opposite end of that scale. You are potentially buying high and then maybe forced to at some point sell low. That's a terrible place to be. Well, anyway, when you get to all-time highs, you know, historically we are at all-time high. But remember, in order to get back to this level, we had to get past, you know, what happened in a period like 2008, where the market, depending upon where you were invested, could have lost anywhere from 40 to 50% of its value. So, you know, needless to say, you had to come up quite a bit. If you were, we'll think of it from real simple math. If you lost 50% of your value, let's say you had a $100,000 investment, you lost half of it. That means you now have $50,000. What does it take? What percentage do you have to gain to get back to where you started? Do you have to gain 50%? No, because a 50% gain on where you are right now, which is 50,000, only gets you up to 75,000. That's right. You might lose half or 50% of your value or your money, but to get back to where you started or to get back to where you were, the 100, you're going to double your money. You have to go up 100%. That's a lot. Well, the market had to recover a tremendous amount going from the period where the market sold off originally. And remember, the NASDAQ, which was the tech-heavy category of the market, that was down. I mean, that literally sold off back in the early part of 2000 after the dot-com bubble in the 90s. It dropped dramatically. And it did not, I mean, we only just recently, I mean, remember that was the year 2000, and here we are 16, 17 years later, only now finally breaking through to a new all-time high. But, you know, interestingly enough, the P.E. ratio, or the what they call pricing multiple on the market back then, was, you know, in the 30s and 40s, in some cases 50s, depending upon the individual stock. Some tech companies had triple-digit price-to-earnings ratios. Now, the long-term average for the market may be more in the 16 to 18 range. These numbers don't mean that much to everybody listening. I get it. It's the change in the number that really matters. So, yes, we are in that range of 18 to 20, depending upon the category of the market. But in generally, yes, that's a higher number than the average. But the thing is, we're nowhere near where the numbers were back in the year 2000, which was really where you had to get where we came from, so to speak. So, yeah, the market's not cheap. That's the best way to look at it. Now, in order to justify higher prices from where we are here in the year 2017, then, yeah, you have to have a fair amount of not just confidence, but faith. You have to be looking at what our government is doing right now. And it's not just Donald Trump. It's, yes, the president's policies. Yes, his desire, seemingly true, to keep the promises he made during his campaign. Some of the promises may have been a little overdone or oversold, but just the effort to make the promise come true might be worth something to you. But the real issue will be is what can the president do that will get the support of both the House of Representatives and the Senate? What can the president do in the U.S. economy that will foster the kind of support from the legislature, the House and the Senate, that they're willing to pay for? And quite frankly, how much of a, who knows, deficit spending program? How much money are they willing to borrow, potentially, to help the president keep his promises? This is going to be the big issue. You have to remember something. A great many members of the House of Representatives, including the Speaker, Paul Ryan, they came to power pushing John Boehner out on the really, with the flame of the Tea Party warming things up. In the Tea Party, where fiscal conservatism is important. And that means that I doubt Paul Ryan, as the Speaker of the House, with all of the influence he has, and he has a lot, I doubt that the Republicans in the House, especially the conservative side, are going to just simply give the president a carte blanche, a credit card to go ahead and do everything he wants. No matter how important the president's goals are, the House and the Senate will require him to be able to pay for it. That's where the struggle will come. Now, what that ultimately means is that nothing happens in the first 100 days. There's only a small handful of things that the administration can do in that short period of time. It means that most things are going to be handled through bills that have to be presented, designed, studied and passed by the legislature. And believe me, when you start looking at government from that perspective, this is going to be a little more time sensitive than Donald Trump was hoping for. He's suddenly going to discover, and I'm sure something that some people have been telling him, and that is that being the president of the United States is not the same as being the CEO of a corporation. He'll suddenly learn that understanding politics is probably more important than simply being a good manager. And in this particular case here, surrounding himself by people who may be solid business people and good managers, he may need a few people in there that really understand the political environment. So, you know, draining the swamp, you might need to go back and find a few of those folks that you've flushed out. Get some of the babies. Don't let them all go down with the bathwater, in other words. But the Dow Jones closed up today, 8 points, not a big deal. 3M contributed the most to that gain. The S&P slipped just slightly, about 0.1%, energy leading things lower. The NASDAQ also declined about 0.1%, so almost basically flat. The major indices posted new intraday highs, though, earlier during the session, and the SPX looks poised for several days, potentially, of consolidation as it digests some recent gains. However, we believe the SPX as an index can reach first quarter targets of, say, 2,400 before any kind of a significant pullback is absolutely necessary and allow them to keep what we'd call your bullish bias. S&P, by the way, is the largest 500 companies in the U.S. by market cap. Folks, I'm Don Sowy. You're listening to AM 790 and the Money Talk program. We're going to be right back, so please stick around. Yeah, we're back with the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowy. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Talking a little bit about, you know, what it is that has been driving this market. We had a really robust period right after the inauguration. Then we had a few days where the market was sort of consolidating and moving sideways. And then here we are back again with five straight days in a row with solid movement on the markets. And with all those gains that we enjoyed getting the Dow Jones back, well, not only breaking through 20,000 on the Dow, but also continuing to go higher and get through to as close as 20,600. So all of a sudden people are starting to talk about 21,000 on the Dow, which would seem like quite a big move. But if you really think about it, that's only about an increase of 5%. But, you know, in a market where the economy has been growing around 2%, a move of 5% is a pretty big move. But there are people who believe that the market does have a problem, and the problem may, in fact, be some complacency. You know, investors are getting ahead of themselves a little bit, according to Peter Cardillo. He's with a chief market economist with First Standard Financial. He thinks that, they're looking at the prospects of President Trump moving forward with his tax reform program. I mean, there's three major indices, right? And along with the small caps, which is the Russell 2000, they all closed at new highs yesterday on Wednesday as President Trump continues touting his economic agenda. Now, that agenda consists of three basic themes, right? Deregulation, corporate tax cuts, as well as personal tax cuts, simplification of the tax code, and, of course, third area is fiscal stimulus, which would be all that spending that they talk about in roads and bridges and tunnels and dams and everything else that you can think about, infrastructure spending. And I think I agree with the president that corporate tax cuts are necessary to bring us in line with other major economies in the world. We are among the more inefficient and expensive tax countries. We have an inordinate amount of regulation that is like a boot on the neck of the economy. And fiscal stimulus. I mean, not just the fact that spending money on infrastructure spending will be good for economic growth and for jobs and for salaries, but we desperately need to upgrade our infrastructure. So there's the infrastructure spending may be among the more important of all three of those primary goals. But economic data continued to come in strong today. Weekly jobless claims holding around their lowest levels in more than 40 years, while the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Manufacturing Index hit its highest level since January of 1984. Now, the bullishness speaks for itself, as manufacturers will be a primary beneficiary of any corporate tax changes. This joins a slew of positive sentiment indicators that we've seen been looking at for months, but that the actual rate of economic growth right now for the first quarter is still estimated to be right around the same 2% that we've been stuck in for seemingly forever, ever since we came out of the recession back in 2008. Inflation data released earlier this week, along with the testimony from Fed Chair Janet Yellen, did lift market expectations for a rate hike potentially in March, according to the CME Group's FedWatch tool. Expectations for a March move, about a quarter of a point maybe by the Fed, we're roughly at around a 22% level. That may not sound like a high level of expectation, but prior to her speech, her discussion before Congress, the expectation number was right around 16%. So going from 16 to 22, it's moving in that direction that moves the potential higher for a Fed move. Now, if they don't do it in March, they could certainly do it in May. My expectation, I've said many times since the beginning of this year, is that the Fed will raise rates. They did it last December, the previous December, so that got us to 0.5% on the Fed fund rate, which is the rate that the Federal Reserve charges its primary banks. The banks charge each other for lending to each other. They're the top customers to each other. I'm expecting probably two more moves this year, which would bring it up to 1%. They could be higher, but that's really – I think the Fed is trying to take great care to read between the lines as, again, as the White House wrestles with the Congress, wrestles with the Senate, and as they all wrestle with the judiciary to see what is legal and what should be and what shouldn't be. In corporate news, investors parsed through quarterly results from companies like CBS and Wendy's, Alexion Pharmaceuticals, and Marriott, among other firms. The U.S. Treasuries rose on Thursday, with the benchmark 10-year yield falling 2.45%. Now, again, note that I said that the value of the Treasury bonds went up. When that happens, the yield goes down. So, yes, the yield on the 10-year dropped to 2.45. And, of course, the two-year shorter note is at around 1.21. The dollar fell 0.7% against a basket of currencies. The dollar trades all day long, seemingly all week long, with currencies overseas. Not against, even though we do track individuals, individual currencies like the euro. The euro is trading about 1.06. The yen's about 1.13. And, overseas, the markets, European stocks declined today, with the pan-European stocks 600 index sliding about 0.33%. In Asia, the Nikkei fell about 4.47%, and the Shanghai composite advanced, actually, about 0.52. Now, when you look at these different types of holdings, you always are looking for some indication of what direction the economy will go in, and then how will that affect stocks. We thought it was kind of interesting that the President of the United States, who reads this, reads that, but he watches a lot of TV. So he probably watching some of the shows like the Financial Network, CNBC and others, was one, he hears a lot of the debate that goes on. So he's up here asking because he keeps he keeps hearing people describe his own policies as being either a strong dollar policy or a weak dollar policy. Well, it just goes to show you that even a successful businessman who's dealt with hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, can sometimes be a little bit confused about, the economic fundamentals and what is better for his own stocks. He's been an investor, right? What's better for the economy? What is better overall, a strong dollar or a weak dollar? So what did he do? Well, it surprised me a little bit. Rather than calling somebody up at perhaps the Treasury Department, although he was still waiting for Mnuchin to be approved by the Senate, he ended up calling at the time, I believe it was Mike Flynn, who was his national security advisor, and asking him, whether or not he should be touting or supporting the idea of a stronger or weaker dollar. Of course, let's face it, Mike Flynn was a general. He's a military man. And unless he was himself an active investor who pays close attention to these things, he probably wouldn't have much in the way of an actual answer for the president. And I'm not sure he wanted to call the Federal Reserve and make them aware that he himself didn't have a solid sense of which was better, a weak or strong dollar. But he should feel bad. When it comes right down to it, it's a confusing area, and almost most investors are at least a little bit confused by the difference. Fortunately, you don't have to actually call the National Security Advisor at 3 a.m. in the morning to find out. We'll discuss it here a little bit as part of this segment of the show. The S&P 500 index sometimes has risen in the wake of a strengthening dollar. And at other times, it has gone down. And that's why it can probably cause some confusion. And this is exactly what we should expect. According to Campbell Harvey, he's a finance professor at Duke University, at the Fuqua School of Business. Somebody must have, with a really great name, must have donated a lot of money to Duke. The relationship between equities and the dollar, he suggested, the professor, is not a simple cause and effect relationship. even when it might look like a strong or weak dollar is having a positive or negative effect on the stock market or its prices. The professor did explain it's most likely that something else was impacting both of them. For example, a strengthening economy could very well lead to both a stronger dollar and higher stock prices. So in that case, some people might make the connection and say, hey, a strong dollar is good for the stock market. No, that's not really true. The answer is that a strengthening economy is good for both the dollar and for stocks. But maybe the movement in the stock market pricing is not attached to the dollar itself. But then it's the economy that is the cause of higher stock prices, not the dollar. Now, the investment implication is kind of clear. Don't base your stock market forecasting or buying and selling on your outlook for the dollar, if you have an outlook for the dollar. Does this advice apply to individual companies as well? Might it be the case that certain firms will be hurt more by a strong dollar or a weak dollar? Well, in theory, the answer is yes, though even here, the cause and effect relationship is anything but straightforward. It could very well be, as companies often claim when they're trying to excuse their poorer-than-expected earnings numbers that they announce each quarter, that the stronger dollar reduces the dollar value of their foreign sales. Remember, they have to translate their foreign sales back into U.S. dollars, so they're dealing with what we call currency exchange risk. If the U.S. dollar is stronger than the foreign currency, like euros or pounds, then those euro-pound-based profits must be translated back into a stronger dollar, and they're literally getting they lose some of that value as part of that translation. Furthermore, as the professor from Duke said, a company's currency hedging operations could very well eliminate some or all of the positive or negative impacts that the dollar's fluctuations otherwise would have. Yes, there are in fact a number of global companies that may be chartered in the U.S., but who do a large percentage of their annual revenue comes from outside the U.S., and they may engage in a series of different dollar currency hedging strategies. Now, even if a company divulges the extent of its currency hedging operations, it still can be difficult in advance to determine what the net effect of those operations will be. Does anyone really absolutely know what direction the dollar is going to go at any given moment? Now, none of that means that the dollar's foreign exchange value is not important, or that you shouldn't care about it as a matter of general public policy. But when it comes to your stock portfolio, there are many more important factors on which it is better for you to focus your attention, more important factors than the strength or the weakness overall of the dollar. Folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa, answering thoughts and questions and things that some of our listeners are interested in. Sometimes they call into me or send me an email at my office, and we may address some of those issues right here on the Money Talk program. And we're also going to talk about a recommendation on market and investments offered by the largest investment firm in the world. What are they talking about right now when it comes to investment and market risk? This is Money Talk. I'll be right back. And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. Folks, thanks for tuning in to AM 790, your home of talk and business. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that Brett's here. He's our producer. He's taking calls for this show at 437-5000, and the toll-free number is 888-345-0790. If you're driving and it's not a safe situation for you to just chat with me on the phone, I certainly want you to get home safely. So just give your question, if you can, to our producer, Brett. He'll plug it into my screen, and I will try to address your question before you reach your destination. Well, there are some names in the world of money and finance that everybody knows. Two of the largest investment firms in the world are Fidelity and Vanguard. But bigger than both of those is a company named BlackRock. BlackRock, you know, they number their assets in the trillions, and they have been at the head of the pack for quite a long time globally, not just here in the U.S. Now, according to a number of different money managers, including one particular one at BlackRock, investors should probably be a little bit more nervous, in his mind, to have a healthy attitude about their money. Stocks have rallied to records, as I mentioned in the first half of the show, signs based upon signs of stabilization in China's economy and the bets that President Donald Trump will boost U.S. infrastructure spending and roll back regulations and cut taxes, all the three primary areas that we were discussing in the last segment of the show. Now, while the stocks markets have surged, in below average volatility tends to show investors are, quite frankly, quite optimistic. Markets are underpricing global political risk, according to Russ Kosterick, and you know, who helps manage about $41 billion in the BlackRock Global Allocation Fund. So what does Russ Kosterick think you should be doing with some of your money in your portfolio? Well, obviously, diversification means don't put all of your eggs in one basket. But he also mentions asset allocation, which is where, if you're going to have a bunch of different baskets, what kind of baskets are they? Where does the money go? More importantly, how do each of those baskets react to differing market conditions? They shouldn't all behave exactly the same way. The term correlation applies. You don't want them to be equally correlated one to another. So what does he recommend? Well, and this is a subject that catches my eye because it's one that comes up from time to time here on Money Talk. He recommends gold. He thinks you should be buying some gold as insurance. Now, I go back to the thing, some gold. And, of course, that doesn't mean going out and buying gold coins or buying the bars or, you know, you hear the commercials everywhere, physical gold. You know, get out there. They claim that no one's ever lost money by buying gold, which, of course, is completely untrue. That's, what is the term for that? Fake news? Fake information? Or alternative facts? Maybe that's a better term. No, obviously, anybody who just a few years ago bought gold would have hit the peak in excess of $1,800 an ounce and then continued to own it. They bought it then, and then they own it now, and now in between $1,200 and $1,300. I would be willing to bet that a decline of $500 per ounce in your gold makes you feel like maybe you've lost a little bit of money. Now, obviously, they could arguably say, well, you only lose the money if you sell the gold. Well, that's true with stocks and bonds and anything else. The issue is, has the value of your account declined? And more importantly, did it decline during a period where stocks were going up? Did it decline during a period where bonds were doing well? Gold is one of those odd things. Remember, in this case here, the money manager, Russ Kosterick, is saying he recommends buying gold not as an investment mix per se, but as insurance. Looming elections in Europe and political uncertainty here in the U.S. are among developments that could shift investor sentiment, literally, you know, like flipping a coin. Adding to the threat is the potential impact that Great Britain's exit from the European Union has had already and may have going forward, as well as a debt crisis in countries we've already seen that had debt crises, like Greece. Now, these concerns have helped boost what we call safe haven demand. Yeah, gold as a safe haven, silver as a safe haven, gold probably the more dominant of the two, but in the same category. Safe haven demand for gold, which has climbed almost 8% this year, 2017, after posting a pretty lousy quarter prior to that. Now, the hiding political risk, that idea of political risk, is not reflected in the markets at this point, according to Kosterick. He says people are not really very nervous, and there are things that could go wrong. He feels that if he looks at the allocations that he's looking at for a lot of individual or even corporate investors, he's not seeing allocation choices that are sensitive to the kind of risks and kind of volatility he feels you should be at least aware of. That awareness is what helps you to diversify and structure your portfolio correctly. And the risks are so different. Now, that adds to the argument for having some gold, or in my case, what I recommend is ETFs or exchange-traded funds that purchase gold, like GLD or IAU. Now, here I am talking about a specific investment, and that's a precious metal. Now, is it possible that precious metals like gold and silver, whether it's in the physical form or whether it is in the form of an exchange-traded fund, because you're basically buying the shares of a trust instrument that is like a big basket that holds nothing but gold bullion. And, of course, the price of gold on any given day will be reflected in the change in price of the basket. So you're buying shares of the exchange-traded fund. Now, is it correct? Should everyone go out and buy gold? No, that's not correct. And I can't tell you, because, well, I can't really see you right now. I'm on the radio. But this discussion is intended to motivate you to go out, to do a little bit of research of your own, but more importantly, to help you formulate questions. The best investors are not the ones that have all the answers. The best investors know how to formulate intelligent questions. If you're working with a financial advisor, I know a great many of you are. If you're working with one, well, when you talk to your advisor, ask them about these things. If you listen to us or other commentators on the air, our job is not to tell you what to do with your money. Again, we don't know you personally. I'm hoping your financial advisor knows you well, knows what your goals are. You should have a plan, a financial plan of some sort, and an analysis of where you stand financially at this point in your financial life. Any investment that's talked about on radio, television, in newsletters, online, this is information to you. This is to help broaden your knowledge, to help you formulate questions, to help you know where to do the research. But only you, knowing yourself better than anybody else, can bring the wisdom to bear in making the correct decision for yourself. What this case here was, we're telling you that a major money manager with a major firm is suggesting that maybe there's a place for gold or a gold exchange-traded fund. I'm just mentioning different ways to own it. Maybe there's a place for gold in your portfolio. In the United States, stocks posted the longest rally that we've seen in 3 years. Inflation indicators are starting to rise, and the labor market is strengthening. Now, that's happening at the same time that a gauge of global economic policy uncertainty climbed to the highest on record in the month of January. Some of this particular rally has been based on the fact that investors expect stimulus from Washington in the form of tax cuts, potentially fiscal stimulus as well, which would be fiscal spending on infrastructure, according to Kosterick. What happens if it doesn't come? What happens if it comes really, really slowly or in small increments? Will the markets, will investors, will people who've been speculating on these things adding value to their portfolio, what happens if they don't come as quickly as they had anticipated? We tend to buy on speculation and then potentially sell on the reality. What happens when reality sets in? Is there something in your portfolio that's intended to help you handle the disappointment or to perhaps handle the risks that come with any decision of this type? Now, while there will be some stimulus out there, yes, the timing, the form, the amount, in other words, the magnitude of that stimulus, are still very, very uncertain. So I think the president will discover, again, not being the CEO of the United States of America, he's going to discover that even the things that he can garner support for in Congress and with the Senate and get, you know, support in terms of legal support from the Justice Department, you know, all of these things may happen the way he hoped sometime during his term as president. Will it happen fast enough, though, to satisfy markets? That's, in my opinion, where a large part of the uncertainty is. There are assets, there are asset classes that do better in one economic condition than in others. Whether you're investing for growth in a growth-oriented type portfolio, whether you're invested for value in a value-oriented type of portfolio, the growth investment style has an expectation that there will be much more stimulus finding its way into the system, much more reason to expect earnings to grow at the corporate level, an expectation that the economy will support higher growth of earnings, and though the higher growth of earnings will support higher stock prices. The value investor is looking at holdings that trade within the market whose prices do not reflect what may well be the true value of that company in the future. It gives you an opportunity, since the opportunity to buy on sale, to go in and buy something cheap, or maybe inexpensive is a better word. So you've got to ask yourself, what style of investing, what types of funds, what types of holdings are best for you? And should you by chance feel the need to purchase an insurance policy, like some method of investing in something like gold or silver? I'm Don Soa. We'll be right back with more Money Talk. And we welcome you back for the last segment of tonight's Money Talk program. Thanks for tuning in tonight, by the way. Okay, this is a question that I received, off the air. Actually, it was sent in the form of an email. It was fairly lengthy, but I'm going to reduce it down because I thought that the essence of the question, the essence of the issue, was very, very important. Let's be polite. Mom passes away. She is a widow. Her three children are sitting in with the lawyers who drafted the estate planning issue for mom. Of the three siblings, you've got, let's say, John, who is himself an engineer living in Chicago. You've got Marianne, whose husband is an architect, and they're living in Atlanta. And then the third child is Susan, and she is a cafeteria, hot lunch program monitor at a school in town, and her husband drives a bus. They all have children. Now, mom, who has just passed away, lived locally, and now they're all meeting together. And one of the problems that sometimes elderly or seniors have, especially when they have children and family who live a great distance away, is they think that they have to give their traveling children, the ones that have a distance to travel, have to give them some sort of a solid reason to come visit. So sometimes they will say things like, well, in the will, I've remembered all of you in the will, so when I pass away, you'll all receive money. The estate will, and there may have been a sizable amount of money there. There's, of course, a lovely house that their children are aware of. And there was a fairly substantial 401k plan that mom had received as a spousal beneficiary from dad when he passed away. And they're all aware of this. So they're sitting down with the lawyer, and the lawyer says, okay, the will says, and then exactly what mom had suggested, that the assets, including the house potentially, that assets will be liquidated and split equally among three siblings. But they said the amount that will be split, according to the lawyer, is roughly $17,000 and change to each of them. Now, just doing the simple math, they all know that the value of the estate has got to be more than the roughly, $50,000 that they're suggesting here. So then the lawyer says, well, what is the problem? Well, apparently the will may suggest that the house should be sold, and this is what the understanding would be. But something has happened along the way, and that is there are designations in this world that supersede the will. Some people think that even if it's an updated will, is that it's all you need. Your will or your trust will not override what is named in what we call the beneficiary designation on a life insurance policy, on an annuity, or on a retirement account, a 401k or an IRA. The beneficiary designation, remember, each of these documents, they ask for, well, what happens if you pass away? Who receives the assets? The beneficiaries are named. Now, it can be more than one beneficiary, but that designation on the documents that are attached to the product, the retirement plan, the life insurance policy, they take precedence over the will. Or as one poker player once put it, the beneficiary trumps the will. I thought I'd use that in this environment. And if you don't name anyone on an IRA account, the state law will determine, where the money actually goes. For this reason, it's really important that you update your beneficiary designations to reflect your wishes. Now, why was this a problem? Well, apparently the daughter, Susan, now these names are all made up. Susan was the local child, the local daughter. And she's the one who lived near Mom, and she's the one that took care of Mom. She's the one that drove Mom everywhere. Mom wasn't driving very well, so she's a senior now. She to the store and to appointments of any kind, doctor's appointments, to whatever was actually needed. And whenever there's a problem at home, Susan or her husband Bill are the ones that get the phone call. Basically, Susan and Bill become the caregiver for their elderly mother, while the brother and sister who live far away are off living far away. So I don't know who gives all the advice at the time, but for sake of simplicity to make things easier, what did they do? Well, they put Susan's name on the deed with Mom's name so that Susan could act on behalf of any business related to the house. Oh, that's really good. So Susan and her mother own the lovely home, joint tenants with rights of survivorship. That doesn't mean that Susan owns half the house and Mom owns half the house. It means Susan owns the entire house and Mom owns the entire house. Beneficiary designation on the IRA that was the rollover from the dad's 401k, Susan is the beneficiary. Just by coincidence, the only accounts that were in Mom's name alone was a couple of CDs and a savings account at the bank. That was the money that was split with the three children together. Do you believe that Susan and her siblings were about to go to war over an estate that was worth probably over $500,000? You better believe it. And that's how families often get destroyed. Hey, I'll have to give you the rest of the story at another time. This show is over for tonight. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in tomorrow, Friday. Steve Beauvais will be here for more Money Talk. Have a good night.